The sales contract document. Some states do not allow license holders to complete contract forms and addenda for buyers, sellers, landlords, or tenants. Under these circumstances, an attorney must draw all forms signed by the parties. Additionally, some states require that each party to a contract have legal representation. Other states, including Texas, allow license holders to prepare standardized contract forms and addenda for the parties to the transaction. The parties. Personal information. The document will include the parties, buyer and seller. The seller's name should appear on the document in the same manner in which he or she took title. The buyer's name should appear in the manner in which he or she intends to take title to the property. If buyers are uncertain as to how to take title, they should be referred to the appropriate legal and/or tax professionals. Addresses for notice attorneys. In some cases, notices will need to be sent to the parties to the contract. The document should include the mailing address of each party. A common address error in a residential sale is to assume that the seller still resides at the listed property. If either party changes addresses after entering into a contract and prior to closing, the information should be updated. Some states require that an attorney represents the parties. In other states, like Texas, representation is optional. An agent should never discourage a party from consulting an attorney for advice in a transaction. If one or both of the parties are represented by an attorney, the attorney's contact information is generally included in the contract. Legal descriptions. Property. A legal description of the property is required. The description will likely be meets and bounds, lot and block, or rectangular survey, all of which are described in more detail in this chapter. While not a true legal description, the street address is included for the convenience of anybody needing to locate the property. Meets and bounds. The meets and bounds description uses terminal points and angles to describe a parcel of land. The meets and bounds description has a point of beginning on the ground and generally starts with the words, beginning at a point. The point of beginning in Figure 6-1 is in the upper left corner of the survey. The survey contains a number of calls that go in a clockwise direction around the boundary of the property. A complete description will usually include a sketch of the property along with the written description of the property. The written meets and bounds description in Figure 6-3 matches the survey, Figure 6-1. Note that the survey also includes information relating to roads, driveways, fence lines, easements, and other improvements. The last call in the description returns to the point of beginning. This method is the oldest and most common method of land description and was used in the original 13 colonies. The meets and bounds description is the primary method of describing the land in states that do not utilize the government survey system. When surveying a tract of land, the surveyor often puts corner boundary markers or stakes in place. A permanent marker installed on the land by a surveyor is called a monument. Monuments, like the one in Figure 6-2, are often the reference point for the beginning of a meets and bounds survey. A monument may take many forms. Some are placed by surveyors of government land. Others may be iron rods, wooden sticks, rocks, trees, or any number of items used by the surveyor to mark a corner. The meets and bounds description is most often used to describe rural properties that are not situated in subdivisions. Small tracts of land situated in urban areas may also be described by meets and bounds, making the method suitable for properties ranging from a fraction of an acre to thousands of acres of land. The meets and bounds description has several flaws that cause problems in transactions. Trees, which are often used as monuments, are removed or die. Stream beds or other natural features that are part of a description may move. References to other surveys may be inaccurate. Accurate surveys in rough terrain are an issue. In spite of these deficiencies, the meets and bounds method is used throughout the United States, along with the Public Lands Survey System. Lot and block. Commonly used in residential subdivisions and commercial developments, the lot and block method of describing land most often refers to a recorded map or plat. When a developer acquires a tract of land for subdividing, the developer will design the new subdivision and lay out the streets, lots, utilities, common areas, and easements. With the approval of local planning authorities, a plat will be filed in the county in which the subdivision is located. The plat will include the location and dimensions of each lot in the subdivision. Each lot is assigned a lot number, and the number, often along with the section and block number, becomes the legal description of the property. The developer will also file several additional items, including a dedication document dedicating the streets and other public areas to the city or county. The developer will also file restrictive covenants that control the use of the property in terms of architectural style, setbacks, landscaping, and minimum square footage. Restrictive covenants are also referred to as deed restrictions or covenants, conditions and restrictions, C, and RS. Maps that show the layout of a subdivision, including lots, blocks, tracts, sections, and streets with the dimensions stated, as in Figure 6-4, are recorded when the subdivision is developed. By indicating a lot and block number for a particular property, one can go to the recorded map and find the property. Lot and block is the most common type of property description used in subdivisions and residential listing agreements. Government Survey System. Also known as the Rectangular Survey System and the Public Land Survey System, PLSS, the Government Survey System method of describing property was adopted by Congress in 1785. After the American Revolution, the United States government was deep in debt and needed a way to compensate Revolutionary War soldiers for their service. The government saw the sale of Western lands as a way of accomplishing both. As a result, the government needed to survey and account for the vast lands to the West, commonly referred to as the Western Frontier. The concept behind the system is the overlay of a grid upon the land, much like a chessboard. Each of the squares in the grid is given a name. Having drawn the grid pattern, the name assigned to each square will describe all of the property within. A grid system needs a reference point, known as an initial point. There are 91 initial points throughout the United States. Having located the initial point, a north-south line is drawn and is referred to as the principal meridian. An east-west line is drawn through the initial point and is referred to as a baseline. Working from the initial point, surveyors establish north-south lines at 6-mile intervals, known as range lines. They also establish east-west lines at 6-mile intervals, known as township lines. The township and range lines establish the grid or chessboard discussed earlier. The resulting square units of land are called townships and are each 6 miles by 6 miles, or 36 square miles. The name of a township comes from its location in the grid. In Figure 6-5, the township highlighted is located 2 townships to the south of the baseline and 3 townships to the west of the principal meridian. Therefore, the name of the township is Township 2 South, Range 3 West, which is noted as T2SR3W. Each township is further divided into sections, each being 1 square mile. Each township has 36 1-square-mile sections. Each section contains 640 acres of land. The land described in Figure 6-5, middle diagram, is Section 14. Its full description is as follows. Section 14, T2SR3W. Smaller tracts of land may be described by their positions in the section. For example, the north 1/2 of Section 14 or the southeast 1/4 of Section 14. Example 1. Describe the northwest quarter of Section 6, Township 2 South, Range 3 West of the Louisiana Meridian. Notice that to locate a property on a plat, the description is read from right to left. Given a description, one would first locate the map for the Louisiana Meridian. From the plat, the township, T2SR3W, would be located. The NW, 1/4 of the, would then be located. Fractions of a section are divided into quarter and 1/2 units only. For describing smaller tracts of land, the section is further divided into halves and quarters. Example 2. Describe the west half of the northwest quarter of the section described in Example 1. Because the west half to be described is situated in the northwest quarter, most of the description is already known. NW, 1 quarter, Section 6, Township 2, South Range 3, West Louisiana Meridian. Building upon that description, divide the northwest quarter in half as follows. The resulting description is W, 1 half, NW, 1 quarter, Section 6, Township 2, South Range 3, West Louisiana Meridian. Informal reference. The most commonly used informal reference to a parcel of land is the street address. While the street address allows the property to be easily located, it is not a valid legal description because it lacks any detail as to corners, boundaries, and the quantity of property described. Except for some leases, a street address is never used as a legal description. Sales price. The sales price is indicated in the document and is usually reflected as the sum of the down payment and the amount financed. Financing information. Financing information may be incorporated entirely in a separate addendum or may be a part of the contract form. The most common type of financing is obtained from a third party, such as a mortgage company or bank. In Texas, financing information is now on a separate addendum. Another possible financing scenario would be the assumption of the seller's existing mortgage. All FHA and VA loans are assumable. Conventional loans are generally not assumable. A third possibility is seller financing, with the seller agreeing to accept a portion of the sales price in the form of a promissory note, which usually calls for the payment of monthly principal and interest. Earnest money. Earnest money is not a requirement of a valid contract. Earnest money is a payment placed into escrow to show that the buyer is serious, earnest, in his or her intent to purchase the property. Earnest money serves as a source for the payment of liquidated damages to the seller in the event of default by the buyer. While there is no set requirement for the amount of earnest money to be paid, depending on the market, it ranges from a low of about 1% to as much as 10% of the sales price. A buyer who wishes to purchase a property with a small deposit, or none at all, would be a source of concern to the seller. Time is of the essence when dealing with earnest money. Suppose the buyer fails to deliver the amount of earnest money within the time specified in the contract. In that case, the seller can terminate the contract or seek other remedies as outlined in the contract. Earnest money is deposited in an escrow account when the contract is signed by all parties and acceptance is communicated. Title insurance and survey. Buyers and lenders are rightfully concerned about title issues and whether the seller has sufficient clear title to convey the property. Most sales involve the buyer receiving a title insurance policy or an abstract of title. Most buyers obtain a title insurance policy at closing. Contracts are usually specific on how title will be insured and who will pay for the policy. Property condition inspections. Most residential property buyers will want inspections performed on a property prior to closing. Common inspections include mechanical, structural, and pest inspections. In some states, a contract may be contingent upon the buyer receiving a satisfactory inspection report. In other states, like Texas, the buyer may have an option period that allows time for inspections to be performed and repairs negotiated with the seller. If the buyer and seller cannot agree on repairs, the buyer can terminate the contract and receive a refund of earnest money. Closing. The final consummation of a transaction is the closing, where the buyer pays for the property and the seller conveys title. In some markets, the closing is referred to as settlement. Automated underwriting systems for loans have reduced the time it takes to close a transaction. In many markets, a transaction involving a new loan can be closed in as little as 30 to 45 days. An all-cash transaction can be closed even more quickly. The contract will have a specified closing date and location. The date is most often an on or before date, meaning that the closing can be held early if all requirements have been met and the parties are ready to do so. Possession. As a rule, a buyer receives possession of the property upon closing and funding. Under ideal circumstances, closing and funding occur simultaneously, or at least within a few hours of each other. If funding is to be delayed after closing, the buyer should be made aware of the delay so that possession and move-in can go smoothly. Additionally, the seller needs to disconnect from all smart devices connected in the home, and the buyer should create new accounts for each device. A lease should be executed between the parties in the event of early possession by the buyer or possession of the property by the seller after closing and funding. Special provisions. For states, like Texas, that use standard contract forms, a blank space is usually provided to allow for special provisions to the contract. This space is where terms can be addressed that are not covered in standard contracts or addenda forms. In all states, license holders are barred from the unlawful practice of law. Therefore, license holders should ensure that any special provisions added to a contract are factual statements that do not change the legal effect of the contract. Seller and buyer expenses and prorations. Both seller and buyer have costs to pay at closing. Typical closing costs include title policy fees, document preparation, recording fees, surveys, inspections, and loan fees. Most fees can be paid by either the buyer or seller and are a part of the negotiation of the contract. Some loan fees related to government loan programs can only be paid by the seller. At closing, prorations for property taxes and property owner association fees will be calculated. Taxes for the year that have not been paid will be deducted from the seller's proceeds, usually through the day of closing. Prepaid items such as property owner association fees will be collected from the buyer from closing to the end of the year. Casualty loss. The contract will address possible casualty loss should the property be damaged or destroyed by flood, fire, or another disaster. The seller typically bears responsibility for casualty loss before closing. Addenda. The details involved in a transaction are so numerous that standard contract forms cannot address all of them. An addendum is an additional form that is attached to and incorporated into the contract. Common issues addressed by addenda forms include property owner association information, lead-based paint disclosures, environmental disclosures, backup contract, oil and gas reservation addendum, financing contingencies, residential leases and fixture leases, disclosures. Some contracts will include certain disclosures related to property condition and other issues. As previously discussed, some disclosures are in the form of contract addenda. Others are additional forms that generally accompany a contract. Examples include disclosure forms that address possible concerns that the buyer may have, such as inspections, flooding, and hazards that may be found on the property. Conveyance of the property. The contract will be specific regarding the conveyance of the property. The contract will generally specify that the seller will sign a general warranty deed conveying the property to the buyer. This provision will also stipulate that the property will be conveyed free and clear of any mortgages, liens, or other charges that the buyer is unaware of that will not be paid at closing. Signatures. When all parties have agreed to the terms of a contract, it should be signed and dated. Some states, not Texas, require that a notary witness the signatures. Statute of Frauds. Under the Statute of Frauds, contracts for the conveyance of ownership in real estate must be in writing to be enforceable. Therefore, a valid and enforceable contract for the sale of real estate must be in writing. Because it does not comply with the Statute of Frauds, an oral agreement to convey would be considered voluntary and not enforceable in the case of disagreement. In the case of two agreements, one written and one oral, the written agreement will always take precedence in the event of a conflict. In addition to sales contracts, the following types of agreements must follow real estate contract guidelines and the Statute of Frauds: listing agreements, management agreements, buyer representation agreements, lease and lease purchase agreements, options, right of first refusal, cancellation and rescission agreements. In many states, lease agreements for 1 year or less are the exception to the Statute of Frauds. In such cases, an oral lease for 1 year or less is valid and enforceable. In spite of this exception, to avoid confusion and misunderstanding, all lease agreements should be in writing.